Okay, dear students, we're going to wrap up our discussion of bonds with some various odds and ends. We'll take a look at yield spreads, the yield curve, bond valuation, the most exciting part of bonds, and then some odds and ends that really aren't that important to the little investor as we are, but it's good to understand, especially because most of us are going to be investing in bonds through mutual funds. So let's start on slide number 20 with the yield spread. Spread is a fancy word we use in finance and investing to mean difference, the difference between one number and another. And the yield spreads represent the differences in interest rates that exist among various sectors of the bond market. In general, the shorter the maturity, the lower the rate, the longer the maturity, the higher the rate. And that makes sense, and we'll take a look at some of the theorems that explain this phenomenon. But in general, it just makes sense. I mean, if you're going to have your money out there for 15 years or 30 years, as opposed to 2 years, you're just going to expect a higher interest rate because there's more time for things to go wrong, right? And, of course, the higher the rating of the bond, the lower the interest rate because it's just a better quality bond. And this is something you experience if you have a high credit score. You get a better interest rate. If you have a lower credit score, they want to charge you much more. And as we've gone through from the least riskiest to the riskiest, treasuries generally carry the lowest rates because the U.S. government, I don't care what anybody says, it ain't going bankrupt. Now, we have a serious deficit issue. Yes, we do, but I'm confident that we'll handle it if we could just get the Republirats and the demagogues to talk to one another in a nice way, but that's a big if. And then muni bonds are next, right? General obligation bonds normally having better quality than revenue bonds, but not always. And then corporate bonds being the least secure, so carrying the higher rates. And non-callable more than callable because investors would rather have a non-callable bond than a callable bond. Slide number 21. Here, as of October 27th, 2017 are the spreads amongst treasuries and corporate bonds. So notice that the interest rates have come up. If you had looked at this just a year ago, it would be 0.2 for the three month. So they've come up, a huge percentage from what they were, but still very, very low. Interest rates are still low. And the 6 months a little bit more, the 2 year a little bit more, and 10 year, which is what most people will hear on the news reported, 2.4%. But here's the odd one. Here's the one that scares me. The 30 year is still less than 3%. The Federal Reserve is starting to bump up short-term interest rates. But the long end of the curve, which is not dictated by the Federal Reserve, is dictated by the marketplace, the bond marketplace, to be exact, hasn't budged. It's still less than 3%. So, in other words, investors are saying, look, you know, I'll take a treasury bond paying less than 3% for 30 years over other investments because I'm so frightened about what's going to happen in the future. I want that treasury. And often, as we will see in one of the theorems, these people are also expecting inflation to remain very, very muted because inflation is the bondholders' worst nightmare, except for the fall, but that's, I'm talking about bondholders in general. When we compare that to the corporate rates, we find that the spreads between the treasury and the corporations are very, very tight, as we'll see. I mean, look at that. Look at the 2 year for the treasury, 1.574, and a 2 year A bond, 1.845, and a 2 year AA is less. Yeah, and you go out to the 20 year, And it's more than the 30-year treasury. Yeah, that makes a whole lot of sense, but not much more. Mm-hmm. Indeed, tight treasury. The yield spreads are very tight, as we'll see on a subsequent slide. Slide number 22. Right. Often investors will speak about the bond spreads as being tight or wide. A tight spread means the interest rates among the bonds they are evaluating are very close to one another. And the example we have in this, which I really should change, right? I should change it to what's going on now, where a treasury is paying 4.8, a corporate bond is paying 5.1. The wide spread means there is a big difference between the bond interest rates. Treasury paying 3.2, corporate bonds paying 8.2. And you'll hear the term basis point, which I asked you to look up back in Chapter 7, which is a silly name, but that's what they call it. 0.01% is 1 basis point. So 100 basis points is 1%. So here in the first example where they're tight, we're looking at, what is that, 30 basis points, right? You know, 0.3%. Whereas here we're looking at 500 basis points, 5%. For several years throughout the 2000s, bond yields were very tight, and then during the Great Recession, they widened to levels that had not been seen since the Great Depression. And now, as we've seen, they have narrowed significantly. Now, what does this portend for the future? Hang on a minute. Slide number 23. This is a graph that's a little chaotic, but it shows that, in general, bond rates follow inflation. So here we are back in 1960. Inflation was running about 4%. Inflation was running about 2%. Inflation is the red. I'm sorry. The bond yield, this is the 10-year treasury bond. The bond was paying about 4%. And as inflation started to kick up, and notice it's very erratic, but it's kicking up in the 1970s, so did bond yields, right? And then inflation dropped significantly in the early 1980s when the Federal Reserve Bank, and I think I discussed this with you, Paul Volcker, who was in the Carter administration, who was tasked by President Jimmy Carter, yes, we had a president by the name of Jimmy, to break the back of inflation. And he said, we'll do it, Mr. President, but it's going to cause a severe recession and probably cost you the election. And to Mr. Carter's credit, he said, you do what you have to do. And they jacked up short-term interest rates, the Federal Reserve Bank. It broke the back of inflation, caused a severe recession, actually caused two. But look, inflation came down to more moderate levels, and so did the interest rates over the next two decades. And then look at what happened in the Great Recession. Inflation actually went negative. Prices started falling. That's called deflation. And as dangerous as inflation is, deflation can be a whole lot worse. Because although you might rejoice at the fact that milk has gone down, the price of milk has gone down, so have your wages. Which, that's the biggest component, right? Wages and housing. So, yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay, so in general, bond rates follow the inflation of the economy. The yield curve. What is the yield curve? Well, this is the graph that represents the relationship between a bond's maturity and its yield at a given point in time. It's also used to make comparisons among types of bonds. Now, in general, normally the yield curve is upward sloping. Longer-term bonds, as we've said, have higher interest rates than shorter-term bonds. Sometimes the yield curve is downward sloping. It's called an inverted yield curve. This is unusual, but it happens. Where shorter-term bonds and bills, treasury bills, have higher interest rates than longer-term bonds. That doesn't make sense. Hang on a minute. We'll see why. Slide number 25. Here is what we normally see. Are you looking at the graph? If not, you're looking at a graph that slopes upward from a low value upward to a higher value. From the short-term treasury bills and bonds that are coming due, short-term interest rates, which are controlled generally by the Federal Reserve Bank, upward sloping until we get out to the 20 and 30-year bonds that are controlled by the marketplace, by the bond market. That's normal. But sometimes we see a downward sloping, an inverted curve, the blue curve, if you're looking at this, where short-term interest rates are higher than long-term interest rates. Hang on a minute. Here's the yield curve today, slide 26. It is still upward sloping. But notice that the short end, the green, is today, and the orange is last year. Notice the green is much higher than the orange was a year ago. Short-term interest rates, which are controlled pretty much by the Federal Reserve Bank, have risen. They've jacked them up. They've risen. I'm getting punchy here. They have jacked up interest rates, as we often say. They have ratcheted up. We often use the word ratcheted up with quarter point increases, and we're due for another one supposedly in December. We'll see. But what's happened to the long end? The long end has barely risen. See? Yeah. And if they keep jacking up the short end, if they keep ratcheting up the short end of the curve, the Federal Reserve Bank, but the bond market doesn't respond and start raising the long end, we could have a situation where we have a downward sloping curve. Slide 27. Let's take a look at the theories, the hypotheses, the reasons that the academics give for these phenomenon. Why do longer-term debt securities normally have higher interest rates than shorter-term debt securities? Well, the one that is it's much less to make sense, but I should cut this out. The one that makes the most sense but is hardest to think about, to quantify, is the fact that investors are looking at the expectations for the future. Well, we know this already. That's what we talk about stocks. I mean, it's all about what people believe about the future. But now we're discussing interest rates. We're saying, what do you expect interest rates to be? Okay, well, that makes sense. Yeah, if you expect them to be higher, you're going to bid the price lower of the bond so the interest rates go higher. And if vice versa, if you expect them to go lower, you're going to bid up the price. You know, remember the inverse relationship of bond prices and interest rates. The maturity preference hypothesis, which is a fancy way of saying, hey, you know, if you're going to leave the money out there for 15 years or 30 years, you're going to want a higher rate than if you get your money in 6 months or 2 years, right? We require a premium as investors for lending our money out for the long term. That one makes a lot of sense. I mean, that's just, you know, it's common sense. If I'm going to lend to you money for next week, you know, I'll say, yeah, don't even pay me any interest. Here's 20 bucks, give me 20 bucks back. But if I'm going to lend it to you for 3, 5, 10 years, oh, come on, I want more interest. I want more reward for lending you the money. And then the last one is the market segmentation hypothesis, which means there's a supply and demand curve, you economics students, in every maturity level. So there's supply and demand going on for 6 month securities, for 2 year, 5 year, 10 year, 30 years. So there's a market. Even though we think of the bond market as one big huge thing, just like the stock market, there are different components of it. And again, this one makes perfect sense. You know, this one makes sense too. So they all make sense. They all have merit. But what happens when the yield curve is inverted? Everything gets topsy-turvy. What factors could cause an inverted yield curve to occur? And what can the yield curve tell us about the future of the economy? Well, dear students, since World War II, every time the yield curve has inverted, where short-term rates were higher than long-term rates, the economy has fallen into recession. There was one exception in 1966 where it just barely hit 0% growth. Didn't go negative. It just came down to 0% growth and then came back up. And as we said, the yield curve is mostly upward. But for about 2 years before the beginning of the 2008 recession, the yield curve had been inverted. Now, it wasn't a big inversion. It was just a tiny little inversion. But that is the bond market, which is far more important than the stock market, predicting a recession for over 2 years. And the stock market in 2006 and 7 didn't believe them. They said, things will go fine. Things look fine. Well, things weren't fine. The housing market was about to just completely disintegrate, taking down the bonds that were tied to the mortgages, and that, of course, the stock market's the canary in the coal mine that kablooied the stock market. It wasn't until the fall of 2008 that the officials charged with tracking the economy acknowledged that we're in a recession, folks. It took over 2 years, but the bond ghouls were finally proven right. Now, why are they often referred to as ghouls, bond ghouls? Well, what happens in a recession? The demand for money decreases. The Federal Reserve Bank usually lowers interest rates the short term. Exactly. Interest rates fall, both in the short term and in the long term, normally. And what do bondholders love? Falling interest rates, because what happens to their bond prices? They go up. Exactly. So you can see that the bondish investors, they are not as exciting and not as flashy or sexy as the stock investors, but they're far more, they were more reality based, as we might use the term. They are more demanding. And so right now, it's a bit of a dangerous time, isn't it? The short-term interest rates are going up via the Federal Reserve Bank saying, hey, things are looking better for the economy. And the long-term bond investors are saying, no, they don't. We don't believe it. We don't believe that the economy is getting better. And that's why investing is so interesting and exciting, as far as I'm concerned, because we'll see who's right, in about 1 or 2 years, or maybe sooner, 2, 3 years, we don't know. We'll find out if the Federal Reserve Bank is correct or if the bond investors are correct. Now, remember, the Federal Reserve Bank probably is the most, they have the most information about our economy than anyone else. But it's not an exact science. There's a reason why economics is called the dismal science. Slide number 30. Let us now turn our attention to bond pricing. Yeah, bond pricing, as we're going to find, is far more predictable than stock pricing. Yes. Bonds are normally priced according to the present value of their future cash flows. Does this sound familiar, dear students? I told you, you're not going to get out of business 123 without understanding the discounted cash flow method, the discounted cash flow model, the present value of future stream of income. Remember, most bonds pay us every 6 months, so we have semi-annual interest payments. And then we get the repayment of the principal. They pay us back our $1,000. Although other factors will always need to be considered, such as the creditworthiness, is this a good company, municipality, are they going to pay back their loans, or are they running into trouble? Because if they're running into trouble, bond investors are going to start dumping the bonds. I hope you took a look at what happened to Ford in the Great Recession, because investors will be afraid of default. That's back in Chapter 9. So, let's take a look at the model. The bond price equals the present value of the interest income, that's the stream of income we're going to get, and the present value of the repayment, that's the one-time repayment at the end of the maturity of the bond loan, right, of the $1,000. This is the discounted cash flow model, folks, except in the case of stocks, we were looking at the future stream of dividend payments, and then we were looking at the one-time sale of the stock at the end of the 3 to 4 or 5 years. In this case, our stream of income is from interest, and we know that's far more reliable than dividends. I mean, you can guess about what's going to happen in dividends, but tomorrow that company could say, hey, you know what, we're not going to pay dividends anymore, or we're going to stop paying dividends for a while. And we don't know what the price of the stock's going to be in 3 to 5 years. We're just guessing. We're just maybe using Value Line or somebody else's guess, and we know that they're probably going to be wrong. But in the case of bonds, unless the company, the municipality, the federal government go belly up, yeah, we know what we're going to get in interest. We know we're going to get our $1,000 back. So that's why bonds are so much more boring. And in the investment world, boring is good because, yes, or as we say, we call them fixed. We know what we're going to get. And we're going to do annual compounding. We really should use semi-annual compounding, but that's what the spreadsheet does for us, folks. You'll see I'm going to reference it in a minute. But there's a spreadsheet on there that does semi-annually, and it's a better prediction, but it's a couple bucks. Usually a couple different dollars different. The computations are easily done using the present value tables, and the spreadsheets make it easier. And then some of you in this class have been using the exponential calculations to do the discounted cash flow model, which is great. Don't get me wrong. Go right ahead. But I'm not even going to show it, all right? I showed it to you in Chapter 6, and I showed it to you to kind of, as a bit of, to show you what's going on underneath the hood, plus as a bit of a joke, I turned it, I said, scary stuff, be afraid, be very afraid. Now look, here's the present value tables. It's a whole lot easier, all right? So this, I'm not even going to show you this. If you want to go to the textbook, it's in the library, pick up your textbook, look at it. It's really not that scary, especially if you like math, but for people who hate math, it's So here it is, folks. Here's an example on slide 32. IBM, you've heard of them, right? And I chose this one for a very specific reason, because we're using the manual tables. You have to get whole number years and whole number interest rates, where a spreadsheet doesn't matter. The spreadsheet doesn't care about whether it's a whole year, 8, 9, 10, 20 years, or 3, 5, 7%. It doesn't care if it's 8.5 years, 8.3 years, 3.5%, whatever. But as of the 27th of October, this bond was selling for $1,279.27. So it's a 7% bond due in approximately 8 years, right? 30th of October, 2025, almost to the day, right? And it's priced to yield 3.041. with a current yield of 5.472. Well, 3.041 is close to 3%, so let's use 3% for 8 years, and it's 8 years and a few days. So the formula is exact same formula as we used when we did with stocks, but instead of using the dividend income, we use the interest income. And instead of using the value of the stock at the end of the year that we expected it to be, we're going to use the $1,000 that we get back, the repayment of the principal. And so we're going to use $70 every year, because that's what we're going to get from this bond. Remember, we're going to get $35 twice a year, so it's actually a little different. And then we multiply it by this present value factor. Where do we get that? I'll show you in a second. And then we're going to add to that the $1,000 that we know we're going to get when the bond matures, unless it defaults. Now, it's IBM going to default? No, they're A-rated, folks. IBM's not going to default. They're going to pay their debts. So now, where do we get these present value factors? Well, I'm going to run down to the table in Chapter 10, and it's very similar to the table in Chapter 6. In fact, this one, the one on the right, is the table from Chapter 6. But this one is a little trickier. This is the present value of a dollar stream of payments. What does that mean? Well, we know we're going to get... How do you get rid of this? I don't like Adobe, but what are you going to do? We are pricing this to yield 3%. So we go over the 3% and we go down to 8 years, and we find that the present value multiplier for a stream of payments, a series of payments, at 3% per 8 years is 7.021. So that's the multiplier for the interest income. In other words, we multiply our $70 times 7.021, and that tells us how much that $70 every year for 8 years is worth today. And we'll come back to that when we get back to the presentation. And then if we come over here, this table is simply it's the same table we used in Chapter 6. It's a one-time payment. And what we did is we started with year 1, year 2, year 3. But here, we're just going to go to year 8 because we're only going to get the $1,000 once. We could use this table and do $70 times this, $70 times this, $70. We can do that 8 times. But no, we're not going to do that. We're going to use the first table over here because it makes life a whole lot easier. So remember these two numbers, 7.020 for the stream and 0.789 for the single payment. So now let's go back to the presentation, and that's exactly what I had here. See, $70 times 7.020. And then $1,000 times 0.789. And I know it. Sometimes you kind of, what am I doing? It's not that hard, is it? Do it a few times and it'll sink in. Because what that $70 is worth to us for the next 8 years is $491.40. See that? Because if you multiply 7 times 8, you get $560. But we're not getting it today. If it were 0% interest, right, it'd be worth, you know, whatever, $560. But we want to discount it. We want to get 3%. So you take the $70 that we're going to get for 8 years every year, and we multiply it times this present value factor, and it brings it back to the present. What would we rather have? $70 a year for the next 8 years, or $491.40. Well, the answer is, if our required rate of return, our expected rate of return is 3%, we don't care. They are equivalent. We could take the $491.40 today, or we could say, okay, we'll take the $70 for the next 8 years every year, remembering that we're going to get 35. And then 35 and 30, you know, does that make sense? I hope it does. And I hope I didn't confuse you when I said if our discount rate was zero. In other words, if we weren't going to get any money, what is it worth to us that we're going to get any interest rate, then yeah, it's worth $560 now or $560 in the future. What difference? It doesn't matter. But we want some interest. We want some return. We only want 3% from these bonds, which is not saying much, but that's what bonds are paying now. Now, the $1,000, again, at 3%, is worth to us today $789. What would you rather have, $789 today or $1,000 8 years from now? Well, if your required rate of return is 3%, you don't care. They're equivalent. So you add the interest income, what it is worth to us today, to the repayment of the principal, what it is worth to us today, and you get approximately $1,280.40. All right, so that's what we believe the bond is worth. All right? I'm sorry, did I say that right? $1,280.40. That's an approximation. Notice that it's sold for about a dollar less. And if we use the spreadsheet, we get $1,277.68 for annual payments, but we get $1,280.93 for semi-annual payments, because that's exactly what we're actually getting. We're getting the semi-annual payments. So all three are very close to one another, but the semi-annual payments are within, you know, 53 cents of the actual price of what it actually sold for. Why is the semi-annual payments prediction higher than the annual payments prediction? Well, think about it, folks. We're getting instead of getting $70 at the end of every year, we're getting $35 6 months, and then $35 at the end of the year. So we're getting our money a little bit quicker than if we just waited to get $70 at the end of the year. And so the spreadsheet responds and says, hey, it's worth more to you. It's worth a couple bucks more to you. I know, we're splitting hairs, right? And so in the marketplace, it's not going to be exact to, you know, depending on what people's whims are at the time. But it's going to be pretty darn close. Yes, dear students, bonds are boring. So there's a presentation on how to use the spreadsheet. And then, of course, there are worksheets that not only do the calculations we did in the previous presentation, but also the calculations we're doing now. And you are not leaving Business 123 without understanding the present value of a future stream of income. Okay, I won't say it again. Slide 33, reinvestment risks. And here are a few odds and ends that, in general, are not that important for us as retail investors, because most of us aren't going to be buying bonds individually. Some people might, in which case, you know, you want to know this, certainly. But you want to know it anyway, because you're going to be buying your bonds through mutual funds, most of us. And so this is important just to understand what's going on at the mutual fund level. You're not going to deal with this, but they are, the folks who are running your mutual fund. Reinvestment risk is the uncertainty about the future value of an investor's bond investments that results from the need to reinvest the bond interest payments and redemptions at yields that are not known in advance. Now, if you're just using your bonds for income, you don't care. You don't care because you're not reinvesting the interest payments and the principal payments. But if you are building a portfolio of bonds and you're amassing your portfolio, you're not using the income and the principal repayments to live off of. You're investing those. And so changing interest rates don't only affect the price of your bonds. They also affect your future income, as you need to reinvest the interest income and the bond repayments. If interest rates have fallen, your income level will fall because you have to reinvest the income and bond repayments in bonds that are paying fewer dollars. The interest rates have fallen. If interest rates have risen, then you're reinvesting at higher interest rates. And this is something I try to impress upon bond investors, because people are terrified of falling interest rates. You know, they want falling interest rates. My apologies. They're terrified of rising interest rates because the bond values are going to fall. Well, folks, take a long-term perspective. Just like we know the stock market's going to fall and we're going to have to deal with it, sometimes interest rates are going to rise. You know, they can't get much lower. I guess they could. They can go to zero, but that's hard to believe that they will. And so you're going to see whether you have an individual, if you have individual bonds, the value of your bonds go down, or your mutual fund's going to go down. And that's what scares people, because they don't know what's going on behind the scenes. They see the bond, they see the mutual fund value fall, and they freak out. Like, no, relax. If you have a long-term perspective, this is a good thing, because now the income and the principal repayments are going to be reinvested at a higher interest rate. Take a long-term perspective. Yeah, okay, well, that's something we've been trying to impress upon you all semester long. So if you put your money into bond mutual funds because you never want it to go down, well, guess what? I have a little bit of bad news for you. But if you keep that long-term perspective and the world doesn't end, you're going to be doing better in the future. Slide 34, duration. Now, here's where we get to some, you know, fairly esoteric things, and the book wants you to learn how to do the calculations, and I don't care. If you want to do it, go right ahead and do it. But this is something that you really need to worry about if you're a bond mutual fund manager, if you're a portfolio manager for the bond companies, or, you know, life insurance or pension funds, or if indeed you are very, very wealthy and you have a tremendous portfolio of bonds. The duration is a measure of a bond price's sensitivity to changes in interest rates and bond yields. This captures both the price and the reinvestment risk, and it's used to indicate how a bond will react in different interest rate environments. The duration of the bond changes as it approaches its maturity date, well, hence the term duration, but also as current interest rates change. In general, the longer the bond's maturity, the longer its duration, and the higher a bond's nominal rate and yield to maturity, the shorter the duration. In other words, if there's a potential for things to go wrong, right? The shorter the duration, the less potential price volatility, and vice versa. So if you're really worried about bond prices falling, you'd want a shorter duration bond. Slide number 35, and this is where we use immunization, which we should never really use immunization in the finance world, but that's what we use. Investors who have a specified time horizon can use bond immunization to increase the probability of successfully achieving their desired goal. So say you have a 5-year time horizon for this money, you would keep your average duration of your bond investments equal to your 5-year time horizon. You would thus be more protected against interest rate induced price swings. Well, what's the problem with this? It requires constant rebalancing of your bond portfolio, since durations of bonds change as interest rates change and bonds get closer to maturity. So are you and I going to have to worry about this? No, the bond mutual fund manager is going to have to worry about this, the pension fund manager. So if you bought an intermediate term bond, which is, 3 to 5 years, the bond mutual fund manager is going to have to worry about duration. They're going to have to keep the bonds, 3 to 5 years, because they have hundreds of millions of dollars or billions of dollars to invest in. We don't have that. We're not going to be constantly rebalancing our bond portfolio. Slide number 36, bond investment strategies. So we're basically recapping here, folks. There are three ways we can make money in bonds. Through an income strategy, where we purchase the bond simply for the interest income. People buy their bonds and live off the interest, or build the portfolio with the interest. Where we take a more speculative strategy, where we speculate that interest rates will fall. And as we said in the past, there are people who are paid tremendous sums of money to incorrectly determine or predict where interest rates are going to go. And then the combination of the two, total return, purchasing bonds for both the income and the possibility of capital gains. Now, which of these is the easiest? Income. Which is the hardest? Capital gains, because you can't predict where interest rates will go. Well, you can predict, but you won't. You'll be like everybody else. You'll be wrong most of the time. And then total return is obviously a combination of the two. And so you're going to see this. You're going to see this in mutual funds. You're going to see this bond income mutual fund, or this total return bond fund, or maybe an aggressive bond fund. How's that for oxymoron? I don't want a bond fund to be aggressive. That's well, they're usually called high yield. They don't call them junk bonds. That's the strategies involved, so that when you're buying your mutual fund, that if you see total return, you know that they're going to try to mix the two. If you see income, well, they're going to basically buy the bond fund for the bonds. And then if you see something like dynamic strategies or opportunistic or something like that, stay far away. In my humble opinion, or high yield, or something like that. Yeah, be careful. Slide 37, bond laddering. Well, remember diversification? Exactly. This is just another form of diversification. And this is a strategy of purchasing bonds with staggering maturities. You buy some bonds with short-term maturities, some with intermediate-term maturities, and some with long-term maturities. Again, is it for you and me, the little investor? No, it's a very popular strategy with pension funds and mutual funds, bond mutual funds, since they have considerable sums of money to invest. Now, what are the advantages and disadvantages of this strategy? Well, let's take a look at a bond ladder. So here are interest rates as of 27th of October 2017. and we would purchase some, you know, treasury bonds and some 2 to 5 year bonds and 10 to 20 and 30 year bonds. So the advantage is that we're protected against interest rates rising because of our short-term securities. They're going to mature fairly soon, and then we could turn around and reinvest them at higher interest rates. But we're getting more yield from the longer term, although not much more, in my humble opinion. Right. I know. Look, remember we talked about the yields being the yield spreads? Look at that. 2-year treasury, the 2-year corporate. That's pretty darn tight, folks. It gets a little wider here, 5-year, 10-year, a little wider. Not much, though. Not much. And then, yeah. So, interest rates are low, bond prices are high. We'll see what happens. Slide number 39. And we are finished with bonds, dear students. Yeah, I know. They're boring. But you got to understand them. And especially as you get older, because you need that stability in your portfolio. Yours truly is like the doctor whose children are not getting the immunization, or the shoemaker whose shoes are falling apart. I really, at my age, should have a whole lot more bonds, but I don't want them. I don't think they're worth it. And yes, I'm preparing myself tremendously for the downturn that's coming in the stock market. It's going to be sharp, it's going to be painful, and it's going to happen. But again, if the world ends, oh well. Plus, I hope to live a whole lot longer. I'm not ready for that yet. Still want to work for at least a few more years. Okay, now we're done with bonds. We're going to take a little detour into preferred stocks and convertible securities, hybrid securities. Very small part of the investment universe, but something you should know, because you are now the investment guru for your friends and family and coworkers. And then, dear students, in chapter 11, we're going to discuss asset allocation and diversification, essentially tying everything together that we've learned so far. And that will be the end of the class. Well, not really. That'll be the end of the class for the information that's most important to us as individual investors. But then we're going to learn some things that you need to know, if only to understand why you should stay far away from them. Options and futures, shorting securities, shorting stocks, buying on margin. Yes, these are things that you need to know and understand, if only to be able to explain them to your family and friends and coworkers, why they should stay away from them and why you should stay away from them. See, excited that we're on the downhill side of the semester, folks. Don't give up. Never give up. Study hard and bring honor and glory to Southwestern Community College. We are very proud of you.